From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, and this is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. This hour, we have a special feature interview with composer Stu Phillips, conducted by Joshua P. Warren himself. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Joshua P. Warren, and I'm willing to bet that you have heard this theme before. Yes, that is the music to Knight Rider. I think just about everybody has heard that before. And it's amazing to know that the man who composed that iconic theme also worked on so many other themes. Battlestar Galactica, Quincy, The Fall Guy. The list goes on and on. I am an unabashed kid of the 80s, and I was amazed to find that the man who worked on all of this amazing, legendary, memorable music, Stu Phillips, he's still here. He's still with us. He's 88 years old, and I contacted him, and I said, Mr. Phillips, I'm a huge fan of your work. It has made an impression on the entire zeitgeist of an era. Can I please talk to you about your life, your experiences? And he was happy to do so. So I am happy to present to you my phone call, my interview with Stu Phillips, the man who defined the sound, the music of 1980s television.
Well, folks, do I have a treat for you today? You know, nothing influences atmosphere more than music. And today I have the honor of interviewing a man who has literally shaped decades of atmosphere on some of the most popular TV shows ever created. Everyone knows the iconic music from shows like Knight Rider, Buck Rogers, Airwolf, Battlestar Galactica, Quincy, The Fall Guy, McCloud, The $6 Million Man, The Amazing Spider-Man. The list goes on and on. It is astounding that one man composed music for all these shows, plus lots of movies and other musical projects. He is a national treasure, and his name is Stu Phillips. His website is stuwho.com. Now, that's spelled S-T-U. W-H-O, stuwho.com, and Stu Phillips, welcome to the show, sir.
Well, hello, and welcome to all your listeners, and I hope I give you some information that you've been dying to know.
Well, you know,
if I may, one correction, I never wrote music for Airwolf.
Oh, really? Oh.
No. I never. It's just that there are some compilations that include Airwolf and Knight Rider on the same disc, and I guess it's confusing. But no, I never wrote anything for Airwolf. And also, the $6 Million Man, actually, I did write music for the pilot that got sold, but it was not called the $6 Million Man at that time. It was called Wine War, and something or other. I can't remember the whole title of it, but just to make a correction that people don't get the idea that I did the music for the series, The $6 Million Man. I did the music for the original pilot that sold the series. Oh,
well,
Warned Women, that was it.
Well, you know, Stu, you have created so much that I think at this point people just say, yeah, Stu Phillips did it. You know, they just brush it over and onto your resume because you have worked on so many projects that have made such a huge impact on pop culture. It's easy to see why the people would give you some credit sometimes that may be a little extra, but boy, the credit that you have is amazing. And therefore, let me just ask you right off the bat, for people who are not at all familiar with you, tell us a little bit about your background in terms of where you're from, where you are now, and your description of what you do.
Well, I'm from New York City, born and raised in New York City. Went to school at Music and Art High School, which at this time is called the LaGuardia School of Performing Arts, I believe. But it was a first thing then, and it was a high school at which you took at least a minimum of 3 music classes every day. So it was very intense, plus your academic. Then I went to Eastman School of Music for a while and decided that I needed to get into the business, that there was nothing more that I really needed to learn up at there. And a degree wasn't going to get me into the business I wanted to get into, which at that point was basically arranging. I wanted to be an arranger like Percy Faith, who was at that time, he since became a composer, but at that time Al Goodman and a whole bunch of other people, Hugo Winterhalter and everything. That was kind of like my ambition. And I hung around New York for a while, decided when I was about 20 years old, that was enough of this. I need to go to California because that I think I'm going to do better there. And so I talked my parents into my going there for 6 weeks, and I stayed for 3 years. And actually was just doing accompanying, playing in bars. I was a pianist in bars, sitting there with a glass, and people, gave me money. And ironically, one of the bars that I worked in on Sunset Boulevard, many years later, in 1978, right above that bar on the roof was this gigantic sign, and it said, Battlestar Galactica, Stu Phillips conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, and that was right above the bar where I used to work, and work for $5 or a buck or something in my glass. So it was kind of ironic that sign would be above that bar at that time. And then when I got out of the Army, I hadn't lived in New York for now 5 years, and I hadn't lived in California for 2 years, and I didn't quite know where to live, so I ended up the cheapest place, my parents, and they always take you in, and from that point on, I started accompanying singers and being their music director and traveling with them. I worked with Chris Connor, who was a famous at that time jazz vocalist, and eventually worked with Jimmy Rogers, who was a famous pop folk singer who had a big hit called Honeycomb and Kisses Sweeter Than Mine. And I went on the road with him, and he was his music director. Then I ended up at a little record company called Grand Award Records in New York, and learned the trade, learned the record business, and somehow got lucky and ended up at Colpix Records as an A&R director. And then fortune smiled on me, and I had a number one record all over the world called Blue Moon by the Marcells. And all of this is for all your listeners are saying, what? What's that? Who's that? Because that was all the way back in 1961 and 62. and then a thing called Johnny Angel with Shelley Favre. And from that point, I kind of edged my way sideways with record contracts that, in order not to pay me large advances, they gave me opportunities to write music for some films, pay or play. And that's how I kind of edged my way into the composing business. And from that point, eventually, after 10 years in the record business, of which I was doing records and show, I was doing the Monkey Show and the Donna Reed television show, and I decided to give up the record business. I thought it was just getting a bit, a little dirty and a little out of my purview or thing that I enjoyed. And I stuck with just being a composer and arranger. And then 1974 came, and I started an association with Glenn Lawson that lasted about 14 years, and did a whole bunch of shows for him, plus shows that he didn't do, a few others like Spider-Man that you mentioned, and a thing called Chicago Story, which was kind of like the preview of every show that's on television now, with like Chicago Fire and Chicago PD and everything else. This thing was called Chicago Story, and it dealt with the police and the hospital and the fire department, all three aspects of it. So anyway, I don't know. Does that bring you up to date? Or right now I live in California.
Yeah, well, your career has been so vast, so diverse. Let me ask you this. What was the first instrument that you learned to play?
Piano.
Okay, and now how many instruments do you play now?
Now, just a piano. Mm-hmm. Because I played, when I went to music and art high school, I learned how to play clarinet. I became a better clarinetist than I was a pianist. But when I got to Eastman, playing clarinet was very nice, except that I needed to be a better piano player in order to demonstrate my compositions to my composition teacher. So my clarinet was became secondary. But at one point, I was a much better clarinetist than I was a pianist.
Interesting stuff there, Sam. Everything from Donna Reed to Battlestar Galactica, all points in between. Quincy.
I know. I mean, you know, like this is pre-recorded, so I had listened to it beforehand. And, I mean, the guy is really interesting. I mean, he's really sharp, still with it quite a bit at age 88 years old.
Stu Phillips, a fascinating interview conducted by Joshua P. Warren. If you're interested in television and movie themes, the conductor Stu Phillips interview is going to be something, you're going to really enjoy. And there's more to come after the break. Speaking of strange.
We come walking down the street. We get funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Oh, yeah. Stu Phillips, our interview subject this feature hour, worked on the Monkees and dozens of other projects. Let's pick up the conversation with Joshua P. Warren and Stu Phillips, speaking of strange.
So now, do you really have to know how to play every single instrument in order to compose something for that instrument? I mean, I know you need to know something about
when you learn orchestration, you have to basically know how to play every instrument. You don't have to have the ability to play it. I mean, but the thing, the knowledge of how to play it and some of the pitfalls that are there playing the instrument, of course necessary if you're going to orchestrate or be a composer that does orchestrate, which I would, I did, yeah. So the knowledge of how to play every instrument is necessary, really necessary. And, hey, when I was doing it right now, no, because you press buttons and a clarinet plays, and you play a button and a flute plays, you know.
Yeah.
Everything is buttons and menus and drop-downs and all of that stuff. There's.
So now when you were working on all these TV shows, what came first, the music or the filming? The order?
In almost 90% of the cases, the film, you always get the film and, to write the music to. But in some instances, you need to pre-record music because they have to shoot certain scenes, and it's necessary that they know what the music's going to be. Like, for instance, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I had to write all the songs and make demos of the songs so the singers could lip sync to the playbacks when they did the movie, you know. So there are some instances of that. I know there are some directors who like the composer to write temp music for a certain scene that they like to play during the filming of the scene for mood, which of course goes all the way back to the 1920s when film first started out, and they used to have like little string quartets or a little violin and piano or something playing music because it was all silent film. So, but they played music to get the actors into the mood. So that goes back almost 100 years. And they've started doing that again. I remember reading a few articles of some composers that had been asked to write a couple of scenes so that the director could play it for mood for the scene. So, but in most instances, you always get the picture. Unfortunately, you never get a completely final cut. You always get a picture that the director or producer just can't keep his hands off of and keeps recutting and recutting and recutting, you know.
Well, you know, the music, it really has to be able to capture the essence and the spirit of the show. So what is your creative process like? How do you watch this footage and see what this product is supposed to be and then create music that really captures that sense, that soul, that essence?
Well, sometimes it's very obvious. You either have two people doing a love scene, you're not going to write action music, you know. I have to speak on two levels here. It's when I worked and nowadays, okay? When I worked, you would have a discussion with I worked basically with producers for some reason. I rarely worked with directors. I generally always seem to come out working with the producer. And we would look at the picture, decide where music was going to be. If I was concerned that some scene could be treated several different ways, I might ask the producer, do you want me to be lighthearted about this? Do you want me to be serious about it? You know, how would you like the music to go? And sometimes some producers would say, I'll leave it up to you. And other producers would say, well, I definitely don't want this to get heavy-handed. You know, I don't want it over the top, so just keep... You'd get suggestions from these people. You would do it, and most of the time, if you were doing a decent job, they left you alone. You know, didn't make a lot of changes. Unfortunately, nowadays they not only make changes, they throw out scores completely. They redo them. They have two composers. They have track music. They do everything nowadays. So, as I said, I'm speaking on two levels nowadays. I think it's a lot different. Obviously, it's the directors who are basically, if we're talking about film, directors are always in charge. If you're talking about TV, it's more likely you're talking about producers. Because directors are long gone after they shoot an episode of television. They're on to some other project. They haven't got time to be involved. So you're generally involved with a producer or associate producer. But in film, it's always the director, and they have gotten to the point that they consider themselves semi-composers nowadays, and they know everything, and they're very, very anti-theme, thematic. Why, I have no idea. I think they think it's corny, but they don't realize that 80% of their audience is corny and has no objection to hearing a beautiful theme played over a love scene. You know what I mean?
Right.
They don't object to it. And for some particular reason, the directors seem to put their efforts into pleasing some West Coast and East Coast critics. And I have no idea, because it started in the late 80s where they're, you know, like, oh, don't get the word they use is schmaltzy on me. In other words, don't give me all this pretty music when they're doing this. Just give me, like, you know, something to fill up the space, fill up the air. I always used to say, well, why don't you use room tone? Why waste your money on music? You know, just bring up the room tone, bring out some outside sirens or something, police cars or something going down outside the window. You know, I said, why do you want to waste $1,000 to write a piece of music that you're not even going to hear and doesn't mean anything? You know, of course, that sometimes didn't go over too well with producers, but as I said, it's two different levels. The level I'm talking about, and you asked me about how I approach it, it basically scenes tell you exactly what they want. You know, push me, you know, advance me, make me sound more, feel more exciting. You know, Lord knows how many car chases I've done in my lifetime. But you know, the feeling is advance the action of the car chase, you know, make it the car sound faster, make chase sound more exciting than it is with the music. Sometimes if you're lucky, you can hear the music. Other times, forget about it. You know, you can't even hear it, so I don't even know why it's written. And the most famous thing that's ever happened is when some producer once asked me to use the chase music from Bullet, the Steve McQueen movie.
Uh-huh.
And if you're aware of that movie, there is music on the stalking of the car as he follows it all the way up until the time that he shifts and puts his foot on the accelerator and starts the chase. At that point, the music ends. There is no music. And yet you would have producers or directors who are so unaware of it that they'll say, I want the music from Bullet, the car chase music from Bullet. And there is no car chase music in Bullet.
Wow.
You know, it's very strange. You're dealing with producers and directors sometimes. They really sometimes are in a world of their own, and they don't realize what they're talking about. It would be a lot nicer if they allowed composers the same latitude they allow the writers, you know, the creativity. However, to probably be critical of what I just said, they are also, if you look on the thing, three writers, four writers, five writers, because they are changing even the writers, you know. I watched a few TV things last night in my theater, and I thought the music was just, you know, wonderful. You know, it was a lovely, lovely job, well done. And so you get these things where it sounds like there was a complete agreement between director or producer and composer, and then they allowed the latitude of some creativity to be able to do what you do, you know.
Such a fascinating character, Stu Phillips, interviewed by Joshua P. Warren for this hour's Speaking of Strange. I really love the 70s TV themes. That's the stuff of our childhood, Sam.
Oh, my gosh. Like, when I saw that he was interviewing Stu, like, I didn't know who he was at first, and I think that's why he chose him as an interview subject, to introduce more people to this guy who had such an impact in our childhoods, for sure. I mean, I grew up in front of a TV, and now as a 40-something-year-old man, I'm still, like, infatuated with TV from the 70s and 80s, you know?
Right. Stu Phillips may not be a household name,
yet,
but his music was sure in every household.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica.
No doubt. Classic. More to come on Speaking of Strange. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange.
Simpler,
you remember B.J.
Time.
McKay? Oh, wow. Stu Phillips, the composer who worked on B.J. and the Bear and so many other great shows from our childhoods. Across generations, man, the dude's career spanned decades. And he's still kicking at 88 years old. Joshua P. Warren speaking with him this hour on Speaking of Strange. Enjoy.
I would say that, you know, one of the things you composed that everybody knows is the theme to Knight Rider. Please tell us the story of how that came about.
It's not a big story. I mean, it was they actually shot this 2-hour movie thing, and they actually library'd some music into it. And the film editor, I believe, tracked in some obscure piece of synth music. Now, this was 1982, so there wasn't a hell of a lot of it around, you know. But he found some obscure piece of synth music, which was nothing. It had no rhythmic pulse or anything else. It was just some synth music to show that, because the car is got a voice that talks and everything else, that synthesized music might work. So the network bought the idea that the synthesized music would work. But Glenn Lawson really didn't want a score that was synthesized. He said he still wants to hear an orchestra play. But he and I talked about the main theme, and he said, yeah, the network is so excited about this idea of a synthesizer and everything else. So he said, let's come, you know, come up with a synthesizer type of music. So I worked on it and played a few things for him, and we talked about it, and he made suggestions, and I made suggestions, and eventually, he said, all right, let's get this thing done. So I got a session, and at that particular time, I figured to myself, well, since I'm not that well-versed in synthesizers, I hired 4 synthesizer players and the rhythm and percussion and everything else, and I wrote out parts for all 4 synthesizers, which, of course, nowadays one guy plays and he overdubs 80 times or something, you know. But at that time, I felt like, hey, this was, you know, why not just treat it like an orchestra and there's 4 guys playing synthesizers? And that's what we did. And it was a little unusual for the time, but I can honestly be very proud to say that I beat Miami Vice by 6 months. Yeah, that Miami Vice didn't come out till 6 months after Knight Rider. So I'm sure Jan Hammer did not need to hear any of my music to compose his music. He was definitely a good composer, and But the funny thing is, people who say, "Oh yeah, well, wait a minute, what did you took that from Miami Vice?" I said, "Dude, Miami Vice came out 6 months after I did." So that's it. It was not a big, you know, deal. The melody, the dum da 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 ba da da, is very similar to a classical piece, and something that's rarely ever played. And God only knows why that was in my head. But while I was playing that running theme, the bum ba da 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 da, with one hand, and as I said, not being the greatest of pianists, and Glenn said, "We need to have a tune that goes on top of it." And I said, "Oh, great." So I tried to play the simplest thing I could figure out, that I could play the left hand and the right hand at the same time. And it just fell on that thing there. And I've been questioned for years and years, "Oh, well, did you purposely use that thing?" I had no idea. I hadn't heard that piece of music probably in 70 years or something. So, but basically that's kind of how it happened. And then network was excited. They loved it. And after I did my episodes of Knight Rider and went to 20th Century Fox to do Fall Guy, and Don peaked after a couple of other composers in front of him, Don Peake took over doing it. Somewhere around season three or something, they decided that they would change the theme. And the librarian at Universal called me up. He was my friend, and he said they're talking about changing the Knight Rider theme. So I told Glenn, and Glenn said, "Over my dead body." Huh. And so he called the network, and the network called Universal and said, "If you change that theme, we'll drop the show."
You know what, Stu, I just want to bring up as a side note here, obviously you are considered by many people to be one of the pioneers of bringing the synthesizer into the modern age, and I am one of those rare birds who actually plays a theremin, and I wonder, have you ever done much with theremins?
I did one thing. I did one thing with the theremin, and I can't remember what it was, but I was as I said, synthesized sounds go back quite a ways to the theremin and a few other instruments. I used the Yamaha E3 organ or something, uh-huh, which is basically kind of a computer sounding thing, you know. It wasn't really an organ, it was a little cross between it. I used that quite often. And then of course the several of the other keyboard instruments came out, and I used some of those. I'm just trying to think. The first thing, 1969, I did a movie called The Name of the Game is Kill, where I used a lot of synthesized sounds and music in it with an orchestra. And not only that, I electrified all the cellos. I electrified just about every percussion. Everything had an amp. Every 8 cello players, and they all had amplifiers like a guitar thing, and they all plugged in. I used a lot of synthesizers in that movie. And that was long before, that was 69, so that was long before 82 and Knight Rider. I also used a synthesizer in Battlestar Galactica in 78. With the Los Angeles Philharmonic, I hired Mike Boddicker, and he played with the Philharmonic on the stage there. And I used the synthesizer like just another section of the orchestra. So there was, I didn't feature it basically that much, but he was playing, and he was mixed in with the Philharmonic, you know, as just another sound palette of sound with the orchestra. Then, of course, Fall Guy, I did a lot of synthesizers in that. In fact, I did about 10 episodes, or 8 or 10 episodes, with just some of them with nothing but synthesizers and rhythm section, and some of them with synthesizers and an orchestra. But I never went for the layering or the overdubbing, one guy overdubbing himself. I always, like, if I hire two synth players, you know, I always treated the synthesizers as a section of the orchestra. I mean, that's not to say that at some times I didn't decide at the end of the session to sweeten something and you know, and double some synthesizer stuff. But basically, I always treated the synthesizers as part of the orchestra, just another section, you know.
And in your case, you know, having worked on so many different projects,
yeah.
Aside from Knight Rider, what are some of the pieces of music that you feel ended up as the final product, a very pure representation of what you created? Because, I mean, basically what you created for Knight Rider, more or less, that's what we know as the Knight Rider theme. What are some other themes that you feel like stand up to what your original vision was?
Well, not so much themes as some films that I've done that are kind of obscure. I did a surfing film called Follow Me, of which I think is some of the best music I wrote, you know. I've written, in my opinion, and I'm prejudiced, of course. But in my opinion, I think I fulfilled my job to the best, and I wrote stuff that I really, really, really like. It was just unfortunate that the film did not catch on big like some of the other surfing films did. That's one. It's out on disc. Most of it, not the complete score, but at least the 3/4 of the score is out on disc. But Follow Me, and then I revisited the first movie I ever wrote for a major studio, which was a Danny Kaye movie called The Man from the Diners Club. And I had not listened or played or anything else because God only knows where the tapes are. Record companies have asked me about them. I can't. Nobody, Columbia or Sony, knows where anything is anymore. But I revisited them. It came out on DVD. They put it out, and I revisited it. And I said, my God, I said, that was my first major movie, and to tell you the truth, I don't think 25 years later I was writing any better than I did for that first movie. And I kind of like fell in love with my score and said, gee, for a person who really didn't know what they were doing, you sure did a good job, you know. It was just that kind of a thing, because at that point I had done one minor B movie in 1959 called Mad Dog Cole. But that was mainly a jazz score. But this was the first big movie with a big star, with a big orchestra, and I basically didn't know what the hell I was doing and ended up, in my opinion, writing one of my better scores that I've ever written. So those kind of things, you know, they hang with me.
Worked on so many great shows, man. Stu Phillips, a national treasure, television composer. Hear the complete interview at speakingofstrange.com. We'll be wrapping up in the next segment.
And getting to the dark 30 hour.
Don't remind me. Donna Reed, folks.
I'm not the kind to kiss and tell, but I've been seen with fire up. I've never been with anything less than a 9.
So fine.
I've been on fire with
sirens. Wrapping up a classic interview with Stu Phillips, television composer. We've all heard his music, even if we didn't know the name before. Joshua P. Warren with a privileged interview with Stu. Wrapping that up and on to the Dark 30.
do you feel like Knight Rider is what most people know you for, though?
Well, both of them. Knight Rider and Battlestar.
Mm-hmm. Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, the original, the 1978 version, not the 2002 version. When I was traveling, promoting my book, went to Europe, did a few Knight Rider conventions and everything else, people knew me for both of them. I would say probably at the time I was doing the stuff in Europe, Knight Rider a little more. But now, lately, Battlestar Galactica, the request this whole concert season during the summer for copies of the orchestra thing to perform at concerts has really, really taken off. You know, been a lot more than it had been. It had been kind of quiet, you know, and all of a sudden this has gotten like to be one of the standard sci-fi themes, you know, to play at all these sci-fi concerts, along with the Williams and Goldsmith and Horner and all the others. So I felt very good about that. And Knight Rider, of course, nobody asked to play because it's a, you know, synthesizer thing. Yet I wrote an orchestral version of it, which I was hoping, people might do just as an encore piece. It only runs a minute and 25 seconds, but nobody seems interested in it. It's a standalone by itself. That's it. It's Knight Rider. It's what it sounds like. God knows how many versions there are on YouTube. They're endless of all the people who have redone it and sweetened it and used it in rap records. Jay-Z and Gun and I don't even want to go through the whole list of rap artists that have used the Knight Rider theme or parts of it, or in one case, one record that by an Indian, can't think of his name right now, all he used was the bass line. That's all he used, but then he combined with Jay-Z, and Jay-Z sweetened it, and Jay-Z put it in his one of his albums, so needless to say, I did very well monetarily on that.
So you do get a royalty, though. So
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. I don't get a royalty from all the YouTube uses of it, unfortunately. The publisher might be getting some, and it might be in my publishing statement, you know, my portion of the money. But I mean, not direct BMI money am I getting on that, but my BMI royalty on all the other usages, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's good, because I'd wondered if you just did that stuff strictly for hire.
Strictly for hire, but that still doesn't mean I didn't give up my performing rights.
So now when you are working on one of these pieces, is there a moment where you say, ah, it's done, it's finished, and you know that it is exactly where it needs to be? Or do you have a tendency to always want to keep revising it? Did they have to sort of, you know, pull it out of your hands? How does that work for you?
Well, me personally, I'm generally, when I'm done with something and I think it's right, it's right. I don't revisit it. I can't speak for everybody else, but I know there's some composers, like you say, you can't rip it from my dead hands until I want to fix that bar, I want to fix that, which is exactly like the directors say, hey, I don't want to turn it over yet. I got a shot I want to put in. You know, I want to take that shot out. In my particular case, I would say majority of the time when I was done with it, I was done with it. I was finished with it. Now that I just compose and for my pleasure and to keep my mind alive, I do constantly revisit and change things over and over again, you know. And sometimes I look at things like 2 years later after I've written it and say, why did I write that? You know, and I fix it and change it. But I have found stuff that I've written that I listen to and say, boy, I wouldn't change another of that. You know, it's done. It's finished. It's over. So who knows? Maybe if I didn't have deadlines and wasn't writing something on Wednesday that was getting recorded on Thursday, maybe I would have been, you know, a little more critical of myself on writing, and maybe I would have made changes, but who knows? When I had to be on the stage at 9 o'clock in the morning and it was 10 o'clock the previous night, and I finished a cue, I said, that's finished, it's done, it's over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've hinted at this, and it's up to you whether or not you want to come right out and say your age. But you are a man who's been around for a long time. Your mind is obviously...
I don't care. Anybody can know my age.
How old are you right now?
I'm 88 years old.
Okay, so now you obviously have a very sharp mind. And how much of that do you think is because that you have spent so many decades involved with music?
I think most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think most of it. I think that's what I do. That's why I do music every day, unless I have, you know, plans to do something other than that. If I really have an empty day, I spend it 3-4 hours doing music because I believe that it's like a puzzle, and it keeps your mind alive. It keeps you. It keeps all the fibers going, and it keeps the blood flowing. And absolutely, the answer to your question is yes. You know.
The clock has got us, unfortunately, but I want to let all of our listeners know that again, you can go to stuwho.com, stuwho.com, stuwho.com. And Stu, you know, I want to tell you, sir, I am in my 40s, so I'm going to be bold enough to speak on behalf of my generation and probably some others, and thank you so much for the wonderful entertainment and the musical magic that you have given us for so many decades. It is just a real thrill and honor to be able to speak with you, and I cannot wait to see what Stu Phillips is going to produce next. So thank you so much for being on the show,
hi,
sir.
Joshua, it was my pleasure, and tell your fans out there, I do answer my emails.
All right, that sounds
personally
good. You heard it, folks. StuWho.com.
Okay, Joshua, nice speaking with you, and a pleasure, and thank you for putting me on.